cave before I went. Drainus listened, intrigued. He quickly came to the same conclusions I had.
So, what are the artifacts from the Erlimagocracy doing in a cave sacred to the goblins? Were our ancestors colluding with them somehow? That, Minolin, is a very intriguing question.
Historically, perhaps. But how does that help us here? Drainus pursed his lips.
Hard to say. Perhaps the answer lies within the Tekka themselves. I can't see an obvious use for either of these, he admitted, but they both seem to have additional components. A pity they don't have them with them. Sometimes that makes them even more interesting.
He pushed it across the table.
Try putting it in sunlight. I don't know much about Tekka, but direct sunlight can sometimes affect them. Other times submersion will, but these don't seem to be designed to go into water.
Idle curiosities, he said,
nodding sagely. I wasn't so sure. After he left for the evening, I positioned all the Tekka I inadvertently possessed across the windowsill, where they could catch the morning sun. I had no idea what that might accomplish, or even what I hoped it might. Some sort of weapon? Tools? I could think of plenty of ways that a gift from our ancestors might prove helpful in the task ahead. In fact, I thought of a few dozen without much trying. Then I realized I was obsessing again and vowed to stop. Maybe, I reasoned, I could pick up a hobby. I was about to go to bed when I felt the beginnings of mind-to-mind contact.
Astaral. Just thought you'd want to be the first to know, Min. I just got a report from a scout in the penumbra. A large column was just spotted making its way out of the umbra. There are more behind it, it seems.
You think this is it?
I asked cautiously. There are 30,000 troops in that column, he reported, and it's not the only one. I doubt this is mere marching practice.
This is it.
All right, then, I sighed. I guess we'd better go ahead and mobilize the troops. So much for a hobby.
Chapter 24 Gavard Castle. Gavard Castle was the seat of the Baron of Gavard, and had been for 150 years. Built before Gilmora's bid to change allegiances and followed the Duke of Castile, not Alsha, the fortress was quite stout. It was built in the Fiamar style, a massive central keep comprised of several conjoined spires and a massive hall, surrounded by two concentric rows of massive curtain walls, themselves studded with strong circular towers. It was an impressive and architecturally majestic fortification, and a century of uninterrupted prosperity had caused generations of the lords of Gavard to lavish it with superfluous ornamentation. It was still a powerful fortress, but from miles around it looked like a burgher's wedding cake. It was strategically located a quarter mile from a massive stone bridge that spanned the Poros River, which bisected northern Gilmora north and south. It wasn't quite on the Cotton Road, but then after Cambrian, we'd systematically destroyed the castles along that road to deny them to the enemy. We'd also destroyed most of the bridges. Gavard was one of the three we had spared, and that was where we figured the goblins would come at us the hardest. 50 miles south, in a smaller castle, Fenral, lay 20,000 mercenary infantry, 2,000 heavy cavalry, 5,000 light cavalry, and the menacing might of the Royal Third Commando. 100 miles south were another 30,000 troops. Whatever got past us and the Third would deal with the Third Army before they got to a stoutly reinforced Barobel. Telamon had been cultivating Gavard as a possible defensive point since early in the war. He had taken great pains to keep it intact. It had driven off two large bands of goblins already. It was well provisioned. When word came that the goblins were on the march, he ordered the refugee camp and townlands evacuated, and fortified the bridge. There were 4,000 fighting men in Gavard already, when the rest of the forces arrived, the local knights and men-at-arms, as well as plenty of yeomen and conscripts. To that, Telamon added 10,000 picked mercenaries, 4 of the best infantry companies money could hire, 2,000 archers and a unit of siege engineers. There were only 2,000 cavalry, but this was going to be a bridge battle. It's hard to outflank a river. And then there were the High Magi. I had called in plenty of help for this battle, as much as I could,
without damaging the war effort elsewhere. Not just the war magi, either, but every high mage I'd given a stone to and could reach out to. Telamon and the magical corps of the Royal Army was there, of course. A score of astute and deadly men and women, well-learned in the arts of mayhem. Bendinald the Outlaw rode south by a circuitous route with 20 war magi from Megalyn, while Azar watched the Penumbra with another 10. Astaral sent 25 from Spark Street in Tudri, and came himself on a dashing white charger. With him rode Master Cormoran and Lance of Bune, and their apprentices. Master Harterian arrived by himself, in full armour, looking far more like the warrior mage he'd been as the head of the censorate than the silk-clad courtier he'd become. Taran led in a contingent of war magi from Wenchar, where he had taken charge of the Order's affairs, while Raylan oversaw the deconstruction of the censorate there. Lord Thinradl led a company of gentlemen, some of whom were lower war magi, unexpectedly, to the castle. Carmella had brought 20 Hessian war magi up from the south, with a 30-wagon baggage train to oversee the support and defences of the castle. She was bored and itching for a fight, too. She brought Sarakim, the master archer and first-class pain-in-the-ass, with her. Since he was instrumental in the last major battle, I really couldn't fault her. Then there was the Sevendori contingent. Myself, of course, with new toys to play with. Tyndall and Rondel, fully grown and blooded and ridiculously cocky. Sir Festaren, Lorcus, Draenus, who surprised me by having a full suit of armour and mage blade, and Sire Kay the Dragonslayer. Lady Ithalia and Lady Fallowen had donned human-sized armour in their human-sized forms, and led a small contingent of similarly enchanted Alka Alon. 60 Alkan bows were in my command, and on Ranyan. The old Alkan was delighting in novelty of the human style of war. He had procured a bronze-coloured suit of bark-like armour, with a smooth, high-crowned helm. He had decided to skip the sword and shield or lance, and while he did possess one of the Alkan metal bows, he was proudest of the massive great sword he waved around at every opportunity. Give a man a pendulous penis, and he just goes crazy. Wenek was there, he and his growing corps of war magi from the Pearwoods. Only a few had stones, and most of the others were the roughest examples of my former profession. Magical cutthroats and rogues, foot wizards turned bandits turned loyal retainers in Wenek's court. He had attracted his own shabby following deep in the Pearwoods, men who sought his counsel and law on the art of inflicting painful death on the foe. They were a shifty lot, but every rusty mage blade was welcome. He was a poor substitute for Azar as a field commander, but I had a more important job for him. It is a poor battle plan that doesn't create strategic reserves. While I doubted that Sherul's generals would use the invasion of southern Gilmora as a feint to strike at, say, Wilderhall, I couldn't ignore the possibility either. Azar and his inner circle were guarding the northern end of the campaign at decrepit Verone, for the express purpose of keeping the goblins from breaking east. Azar and his men would not be enough to stop such a campaign, but they could slow them down enough for the rest of us to get there before they got too far. He grudgingly accepted the role on the condition he have full access to the taverns, casinos, and bordellos of Verone. As if I could have stopped him. Lastly came the non-combatant contingent of High Magi who, nonetheless, were bound to my summons by their stones. While they were nearly useless in battle, there were thousands of spells that could be cast in support. That, too, had played a pivotal role in the Battle of Cambrian. Had not the non-combatant magi mustered the power to raise a storm at a crucial point, I would be dragon shit. For this battle, I felt they would be of most use off-site. Gavard Castle barely had enough room for the fighting men, and a cluster of non-combatants would cost men to defend them and provide a vulnerable target for our foes. Instead, we had them installed in a spacious but vacant manor house 10 miles to the southeast. Guarded by 1,000 mercenary horse and 1,000 infantry, the manor was part of a complex that included a temple and a hospital. That became our fallback position, in case the skies above Gavard got too dragony. We could get there in a hurry, and hold out long enough for the third commando to come rescue us, if necessary. It also gave us a perfect spot to evacuate our wounded. Post riders and pickets were set up, and the road between the two installations was heavily patrolled. Pentandra was in charge of the unit. As my lieutenant in the order, she already had wide respect and acknowledged authority, over and above what her character demanded. She had donned her pretty armor again for the occasion, and commanded the station with an iron grip. She chose Planus as her assistant, and quickly organized the place by section. The medical order took over the hospital. The observation corps, as we called Lance of Bune's masterful map, was set up in the main sanctuary of the temple, with the manor used as a residential hall and mess. It was a tight operation. Pentandra was getting really good at that sort of thing. But it also meant she had to deal with some unusual problems. In this case, Lord Dunsellin. Dunsellin had, surprisingly, responded to the summons to battle by actually showing up. I almost regretted it. And Pentandra certainly did. He looked even more slovenly than usual. He was escorted by an even larger fawning entourage than he'd brought to Sevendor. Not only were his pet unaugmented war magi hovering around him, but so were several of his vassals he'd brought along as a personal guard. He'd also included his harem, at least 6 young women he'd taken from their homes, in various stages of consent, accompanied the old wizard on his campaign. Including his grooms, servants, and victuallers, the man's household was nearly 50 strong.
"I don't know what to do with him," fumed Pentandra on a visit to Gavard Castle to discuss supplies. "He's demanding that we cede half of the manor to him, 2 entire bays. There's no way," she said with a disgusted snort. "We've still got high magi trickling in we need to house. I'll not see 50 of them relegated to monk cells or under tarpaulins while he and his sluts wallow under a roof."
"Why, Pentandra," I mocked. "I figured you of all people would appreciate the old boy's healthy libido."
She looked genuinely ill.
"I've seen them, Min. You haven't. 2 or 3 are there for the attention and the fame. And the money?"
She conceded, but a few of them look like they're scared for their lives.
"It's not like we don't have enough whores infesting the place. Not just the usual camp followers. There are refugees everywhere, and they'll do anything for a crust of bread," she said grimly. "I've pressed as many into service as I could as stretcher-bearers, cooks, and orderlies," she sighed. "But I have to feed them, too, and house them, and I'm not going to put up with that...
"I understand," I said gently, holding up my hand. We were in the grand suite of the Baron, who had kindly ceded its use for the war effort. He was encamped with his men in town now, in one of the finer taverns. The place had a remarkable collection of maps, and a beautiful one of the local region was spread across the even more beautiful rosewood table the Baron chose to drink around in his quarters. I looked around for a solution, and found one almost immediately. "There's a manor, 6 miles to the west of you. Massafar, I believe it is. There was a big ginning operation there before the war. It's been attacked and abandoned, but we have an outpost there, mostly to speed riders south. About 50 men. The manor there is a wreck, but it's habitable. Deploy Dunsellin and his men there in support of the outpost. That will keep them out of your hair, keep them out of battle, and maybe he can even do something useful. Eventually."
"That might actually work.
He can rut with his whores through the whole battle, for all I care. But
there is one more thing," she added hesitantly.
"What?"
"He's not alone. Among his household was a special lady friend, Lady Isseli."
My breath caught.
"What?"
I demanded.
"I saw her, Min," she confessed guiltily. "She was standing in the background, and I almost didn't recognize her until I saw her walk. I asked one of the carters who accompanied them about her. She's been living at Dunsellin's palace for a few weeks now. They've gotten close."
There was no mistaking the uncharacteristically subtle reference. I don't know why that angered and irritated me. It shouldn't have. But I was offended that the old goat was rutting with the beautiful Shadow Mage assassin for some reason, even though I guessed why she was suddenly so enamored with a demented, slovenly old mage. I felt a tinge of anger at the thought. "She isn't there by accident," I reasoned, my fists clenching. "She had to be ordered there."
"And Dunsellin should know better,"
Pentandra said with great irritation.
"I know the man is half mad. You should have heard him ramble on while he was demanding half the manor. But he was Rard and Grendine's court wizard for years. He has to know who Isseli is, and who she represents."
Yet she's managed to get pretty close and has not struck yet, I pointed out. What does that tell you?
That she's waiting for the perfect opportunity?
She ventured, biting her lip. I shook my head. No. She's had dozens of opportunities already. I don't care how on guard Dunsellin might be. If Isili wanted him dead, he'd be dead. She's a shadow mage. He's not even a war mage. He's a glorified spellmonger with a few publishing credits. Isili is in a position to slay him, but she's awaiting the order to do so.
Why wait?
Out of deference to me, I admitted, a little sheepishly, and as a goad. I told Grendine that I would handle Dunsellin. This is her way of reminding me of that. If I don't do it, she will, I'd guess.
And Isili is just going to let that old ass paw her and such, until she gets the word?
She's very loyal, I said darkly. Pentandra saw my look and did a double take. No doubt she recalled just how loyal Isili had proved to the family. Loyal enough to bear my bastard child. Of course, Pentandra did not know that I knew about that yet. I was curious if and when she'd reveal that knowledge.
She has a stronger stomach than I,
Pentandra said smoothly. There was no trace of guilt or deception in her eyes. Penny was good.
It would feel like getting humped by a pervy old uncle or something, she said, shuddering. The man's personal habits are vile. So is his company.
Then I don't mind if she's forced to endure it in the line of duty, I decided. Pentandra studied me a moment. Now she looked guilty.
Min, you know, I could have her sent here, she proposed. I know you still have feelings for her, somehow. I could get her sent here, away from Dunsellin.
And into my bed, was the unspoken predicate of that sentence.
Alia is very far away, she rationalized. It's right before a battle. She's very beautiful, she admitted almost spitefully. I wouldn't blame you, and no one would ever know. You see High Magi coming in for deployment all the time, and a couple of hours.
I tried to control myself while she spoke, but I finally just could not stand it.
No,
I interrupted. I waited for her to speak, and she started to, but then she stopped again and waited for me to continue. No, I don't want her sent here. Let her fulfill her mission, I spat angrily. Let her languish in his flabby arms, under his growing bulk. I don't want her. I don't want her anywhere near here, I decided.
Min, I...
she began. I didn't let her. No, Penny. I know what you were trying to do, and I appreciate it. More than you know. It proves that you're looking out for me, even if it means betraying Alia to do so.
Min, I never meant...
I know exactly what you meant, Pen, I said gently. I do. You really were looking out for me. You'd set it up, let me cheat, and never say a god's damn word about it. Not before the thrones of the gods themselves. Am I wrong? I demanded.
No,
she answered sheepishly. And I appreciate that. You're someone I can count on, Pen. One of the few in the world, I realized. If you ever betrayed me, I don't know what I would do. Sure, I could tumble easily with a glance. This is the perfect opportunity. But upon further consideration, as anxious as I am about that column marching down the road against us, I don't want her.
Min, Alia would understand.
I wouldn't, I insisted. Trig knows I'm no monk. I've done things I'm not proud of, I admitted, looking away. Things I shouldn't have, perhaps. Do you know how badly that eats at me? I demanded. How much it hurts me to look at my children, to look at my wife and realize I haven't done my best by them. I know we're in a war zone. I know we're days away from battle. I might be dead in a week, I added, a popular phrase associated with the morbid-minded men of the Iron Band for some reason. But if I am to die in this battle, I want it to be with a clear conscience.
Min, I know how you get, Pentandra warned. It's expected for the officer class to release some tension before battle. You're going to be under a tremendous amount of pressure in this battle.
And in the next one, and the next one, I countered. And yes, I know it's frequently done. Hell, half the reason that Kusi volunteered for duty in Faris was to get a shot at dusky Farisian whores. Camp followers are as much a part of military life as guard duty. But, I continued, I'm not a dashing young spark anymore. I'm a married man who happens to love his wife, and I have responsibilities. I'm 24 for Ishi's sake, I said, disgusted with myself for even considering the matter. Alia deserved better.
Min, it's okay, Pentandra soothed. To be honest, I'm glad to hear it.
And surprised.
Why surprised?
Because I was afraid that the allure of power and fame would change you,
she admitted.
And it has. Just not in a way I predicted. I thought you'd take advantage of your position.
As you've just reminded me about Dunsellin and Isili, is that every smiling face conceals fangs. Every curvy bosom hides a dagger. Every such encounter I have is fraught with potential disaster and ruin. Women who put themselves in such positions invariably have hidden agendas and secret desires.
Precisely,
she said, looking a little relieved. That's why I'm surprised you figured that out. When you first married Alia, I was concerned, I admit. But in retrospect, your marriage has probably shielded you from 10 times that kind of attention. The Baroness of Seven Doors' frosty appearance at court is still being spoken of in the proper circles. That warned off the weak-willed opportunists, mostly. And you having a safe and secure outlet for your precious, she said, making a face, has done you a world of good. She's good for you, Min. I know that. I didn't want to mention Isili, but...
I understand, I repeated. I do. More than you know. I took a deep breath. I was about to do something stupid, and I needed to steel myself. Particularly in light of the child we have together. She looked at me, stricken. Then she gathered her wits.
You know?
All of it, I nodded. How she's being raised in Wenshaw by a couple of loyal retainers. How mother plans on using her as a pawn and leverage against me. How she was conceived directly by her order.
Oh, Min,
she whispered, shaking her head. I didn't want to ruin your happy life and perfect little family.
I am so sorry. I never meant...
I know, I said quietly. It's not your fault. You were trying to protect me. You weren't wrong to do so. But I found out, and I've placed a watch on the girl. Isili does not know I know. No one knows I know, save for a few I trust.
You don't know what a weight that lifts from me,
she admitted.
I felt awful keeping it a secret. Like a betrayal, yet...
Agreed. Which is why we're discussing it now. Because I can't let our mutual policy be overturned by mistrust between us. I must have your trust, Penny, and you mine. It's not about my life, as much as we both try to protect it. This is a lot bigger than us. There is a kingdom at stake. Hundreds of thousands of lives. That's bigger than my libido or my hurt feelings, or even Alia's. So, I cannot let it stay a secret. Not from you. Not between us. And now that we both know about it, we can work together.
I'm so glad you feel that way, Min,
she said guiltily.
I've been carrying this around for 2 years now. What if Alia finds out?
I winced. Let's not speculate on my worst fears while 150,000 goblins march down the Cotton Road. If we get through this battle, then we can work on my personal life.
And mine,
she sighed.
What? You have a personal life? I asked, surprised.
Would it shock you that I might have found a man, encompassing my lofty standards, and discerning eye for character?
Only if he didn't also have a battering ram in his tights. Why, did you find a soldier boy you like? One that Mummy and Daddy won't object to?
Oh, they don't care anymore,
she dismissed.
Orsirio is enjoying being one of the highest status magi in Rhymir. Mother is obsessed with my sister's social positioning. They won't care if he's a drooling idiot, as long as he can legally wed and beget grandchildren.
So, who is this mysterious suitor? I asked, surprised but delighted. I could tell Pentandra was indeed infatuated over someone. She'd once had that look for me, a few years ago. A lifetime ago.
Captain Arborn,
she replied softly.
Arborn? Of the Kasari? I asked. Amazed. I knew you were goofy over his tall, dark, and handsome looks, but... Pen, he isn't Rhymirian. He's not even one of us Narasi barbarians.
He's Kasari. Arborne had appeared at Gavard Castle with 500 of Kasar's best rangers, as part of our bargain. The Kasari were now ranging the lands north of our position, scouting and laying traps, and most importantly clearing any stray civilians out of the march of doom from the north. Arborne was their commander, and he had been in and out of the castle all week.
Exactly,
she snapped. He isn't landed, he isn't titled, he has no social position for my parents to capitalize upon. He spends his time on dangerous missions deep in the wilderness, facing horror and evil all the time. He's a man, she emphasized, not a silken, perfumed fop like my cousin Planus. He's kind, he's loyal, he's trustworthy, she emphasized.
Really? Not just out of politeness' sake, I've really fallen for him, Min,
she admitted hoarsely. It's as if he's the first real man I ever met.
Hey! Oh, you were a boy, and we both know it. And I was a silly girl who thought I would be happy pursuing my career and my research. I've humped plenty of brawny stable boys, she said, with a trace of pride. I've done some incredible research in my field when my administrative duties leave me time. But I'm of an age where that is ceasing to be as important to me, she admitted. I look around at what is available to me in the way of a husband, however, and I'm disappointed. Oh, they are manly enough, but they are boors, men who care not for a wife's intellect, and only for her body and her capacity to breed heirs.
What makes you think Arborne is any different? I asked, curious. It was true. The Kasari Ranger captain was far outside of Pentandra's family's social sphere, but then I knew that they had never held out hopes that their magically talented daughter would prove to be a marriage prize. And love? Rhaemeran culture is full of tales of love. The place is soaked in it, but rarely between husband and wife. Rhaemeran nobility married for dynastic positioning and to produce heirs. Love was something you cultivated with exciting young mistresses or dashing young guardsmen. The fact that he has nothing, she replied. He has the clothes on his back, his horse and his weapons. When he goes home to Kasar, he sleeps in a camp. He doesn't own land, doesn't want to rule a domain, and has no aspirations of founding a dynasty. All he has is himself. His big, strong, hyper-competent, constantly ranging self to offer me.
And that's sufficient, I asked, curious.
It's ideal,
she breathed, smiling beatifically.
I have money, Min. I have power. I have respect, lands, title. None of that a husband could grant me in marriage. But a man who has nothing to offer me but himself, and such a worthy self? There is no competition betwixt husband and wife there, Min. He has no need to dominate me with his importance or his wealth. If he is to tame me, it will be with his soul.
I stared at her and blinked. You do realize what a horny little schoolgirl you sound like, don't you?
It's the truth, she snapped. Believe me, I've studied the matter. Sex magic isn't all about fiction and fantasy, you know? There is an awful lot about male and female mating involved, believe it or not.
I know, I said defensively. Those hadn't been my favorite parts of the discipline, but Penny had studied them religiously, and had forced me to be familiar with the basics.
Then you should know that I have no desire in a man I could dominate easily, and I dare you to show me one in the Riverlands who would be immune from that, without giving cruelty in return. The man I wed must have my respect, first and foremost, and he must respect me and the life I have built before we bind our fates together. He must be my steady rock. He must be strong enough to resist my childishness, and do so without berating me for it. He must be as kind and gentle as he is strong and fierce. He must be able to lead me as a husband, and more importantly, he must be worthy of me following him. Else our marriage will be a sham,
she pronounced. I blinked. Penny, I'm stunned. And you think Arborne has these qualities?
He has yet to fail me,
she pronounced.
Should we both live through this battle, I plan to press my suit.
Penny, surely you know that traditionally a man is the one who pays court, I reminded her gently.
And you think a woman has no influence on that decision?
She snorted, surprised.
Men.
I've studied men the way you think you've studied thaumaturgy. Men are simpler. Arborn has a reputation as a lifelong bachelor. It will take some extraordinary measures to overcome that resolve. But if there is a woman alive who can do it, she's me. Is she willing?
She added. I gave her a hug and wished her the best, then saw her off at the stables. She had just departed with her guard when I received a message, mind to mind.
Min, where are you? Tarleman demanded.
In the stables. Reflecting on Pentandra's social life.
Why?
We just received a report from our forward outposts. He told me, the Goblins' vanguard has moved ahead of the main column and is making their way toward the bridge now.
Shit.
How many? How much time do we have?
It sounds like 10,000 or so,
he said grimly. More than half are riding fell hounds. They're sending their light cavalry in advance. If they keep going like they're going, they'll reach Northbridge by dusk.
Just in time for a night attack.
Very well. Then it's time to button up, I decided. Recall our patrols. Deploy the siege engines, and activate the bridge defenses, and tell the magical corps it's time to start their defensive spells along the entire south bank. Send word to Rad and the rest of the army. I'm going to don my armor and prepare myself. I'll join you in the headquarters room when I'm ready.
Yes, Commander,
Tullerman said smartly.
Shit, at least they didn't attack in winter,
he pointed out. This would be a lot harder to do in the snow. I guess those iron shoes weren't pertinent.
We have no idea what the goblins are planning, I countered as I began to walk to my quarters. But if they were using those shoes for traction on ice and snow, that moment has passed.
I saw Rondel coming out of the mess pavilion we'd set up in the bailey to feed everyone, and I gave him the sign to make ready. He caught my eye and understood at once. In moments, dozens of men were streaming out of the tent on their way to their stations.
Deploy your men, Commander.
It would be my pleasure, Marshal.
He sounded enthusiastic. I hoped that was a good thing. I spent almost an hour preparing. That sounds like a lavish amount of time, but there was a lot more to it now. I had high-quality armor, custom-made, my heart protected on back and breast by dragonhide, salvaged from the huge beast we'd slain at Castle Cambrian. Cormoran had had it made especially for me, and had given Sire Kay a similar set of armor. The dragon's hide was not only supremely tough, but its anti-magical properties would protect my torso from combat spells of a direct nature. My helmet was a short-cheeked, low-crowned, close-fitting affair, with an intricate visor. It was well padded with wool and cotton, and it was enchanted for protection and durability. I wore Twilight on my back, and carried a half-dozen war wands at my belt. And, of course, my sphere floated belligerently over my shoulders. In battle, I could send it overhead, out of direct danger. But I didn't mind having it around, reminding everyone who I was. It saved on the effort of returning a salute. But my new toy, Blizzard, was my weapon of choice for this battle. I had two quick glasses of spirits before I mounted the stairs to the over-decorated spire we had chosen as our command center. Lance of Bune had set up a simple but workable diorama of the battlefield for our study, and there were maps and dispatches on trestle tables all over the place. Against one wall were four beastmasters, who were in rapport with various birds overflying our foes. Dara had taught me the usefulness of such flying spies at Cambrian. So far, the goblins had not caught on to that trick. The priests were obscuring their march from scrying, but our scouts in the sky were quite capable of seeing their approach. And what an approach it was. I glanced at the diorama, where cunningly carved little figurines represented friend and enemy alike. It was being updated with every fresh report. Our forces were represented by toy soldiers defending a blue painted line across the floor. The river fortification on the south side of the bridge was packed with men, as were the townlands behind it. The drawbridge had been lowered, allowing the goblins the freedom to plunge into the icy depths of the river and drown as our archers shot them from the other side. And we had a dozen or more catapults and trebuchets built in behind the bridge. Any attempt at approaching the site with a siege train would see it struck hard on its way. Naturally, the townlands north of the river had been well seeded with spells and enchantments to make an attack burdensome on the Gavanni. I had placed dozens of berserker spells myself in the days leading up to this battle. Even getting to the bridge was going to be problematic. I hoped. The forces arrayed against us were strong. According to the map, there were thousands of Fellhound riding Gavanni pouring into the region, sweeping away the last bit of resistance before the main column arrived. We had not left much behind for them to forage or destroy. The Kasari Rangers had laid their snares and traps and withdrawn to south of the river, and only a few outposts along the road remained. Those retreated at the first sign of trouble, as ordered. Now it was just a matter of holding that bridge, as long as it took. To let them pass was certain doom, and I had the greatest strength I could muster here. The battle had come at last, and I was as ready as I could make myself. Chapter 25. The Battle of Gavard Crossing. I had no idea how they did it, but it changed the war. The Gavanni enchanted the Poros River at its highest spring flood stage, and turned it into solid ice. Goblins don't like water. They don't swim, they don't use boats, and they hate to be wet. The Poros and the other great rivers of the Riverlands were natural barriers to their troop movements. The Poros was one big wall of water keeping them north, making them rely on a handful of bridges and fords to cross. The idea of an amphibious goblin attack was ludicrous. But now the Poros was frozen. Not just the first few inches. It didn't take much magic to reveal that the entire thing, and all its tributaries we learned, was frozen from surface to depth. Frozen solid. Instead of a wall, the Poros was now one large bridge into the heart of Gilmora. A bridge the thousands of goblins and fell hounds who had gathered north of the river did not hesitate to use. It was sudden. I made it to the castle gates a mere hour before the first howling packs of goblins ranged through our area. We spent just long enough to disable the siege engines we'd put together so carefully, lest they were turned on us, before we retreated. The last defenders from the bridge made it back to the castle just moments before the first fellhounds padded into the townlands. Of course, we did not let them pass unmolested. We had plenty of defenders, and a goodly number of cavalry, not to mention the best war magi in the world. The goblins sent thousands after Castle Gavard that night, and they found fierce resistance. War magi and soldiers fought in the streets outside, and then at the castle gates. Arrows poured down from the walls at any hound foolish enough to come that close. Knights and men-at-arms ranged the perimeter of the castle, challenging any goblin stupid enough to stand still. It was a bloody night, and dawned a bloody sun. The goblins never made a concerted attack, just harassed us enough to keep the majority of our forces pinned down. It was more of a nuisance than a fight for survival, but it kept the sentries and archers busy. A couple of war magi used the opportunity to try out new offensive spells, but I was more concerned about the wider battlefront, now that the Poros was no longer a barrier. Reports began pouring in, mind to mind, by mirror, and by traditional means. Within a few hours we were starting to get a larger picture of the battle. Our headquarters was chaos. Our agents were using the two mirrors we'd installed here liberally. Several more magi were detailed just to communicate mind to mind, passing instruction and intelligence to Telemann and myself as we tried to manage the crisis. There was little need for us at the castle walls yet, but there was plenty to do when it came to spreading the word of the sudden and unexpected shift in the battle. Elsewhere, they were less orderly in their attacks. Thousands of wicked-looking hounds spread out after crossing the river, and ran in great packs to the few villages and manors still inhabited in the region. They bypassed many of our fortified outposts in favor of concentrations of poorly protected humans. But they spared no settlement, their dreadful touch. Their hounds could not run as fast or as far as horses, but they tired less easily and recovered more quickly. They made good time. By dawn's first light, they were already 20 miles south of us, encountering elements of the Third Commando. We had some help. Besides being an increasingly good assistant castellan, Sir Festaren was a mage knight of very slight power. That did not bother him. He had mastered a few cantrips and could use mage sight. With a little effort he could even summon a small mage light. But that was not where his talent had taken him. Sir Festaren's particular agira allowed him to estimate just about anything with uncanny accuracy, and we used that talent liberally.
As reports came in and were relayed to Lance of Boone's map team, Sir Festaren looked over the figures and made adjustments and corrections. Day broke through the arrow slits in the wall, while the young knight worked with wax, boards, and parchment, trying to assess the truth of the dispatches.
35,000, he reported sleepily. That's how many have crossed so far. 35,000 goblins in one night, he said, shaking his head in disbelief of his own figures. There are at least another 100,000 and more yet on the road. We'll know more when we can get the hawks in the air.
Dara is flying.
Why wouldn't she be?
Festaren shrugged.
There's a war on. Terlaman gave the orders.
I didn't bother Terl with the question. If he needed my youngest apprentice risking her life in the air over Gilmora, I wasn't going to second guess. When the Poros froze solid, we all became expendable. At morning's first light, our situation looked dire. Gavard was effectively cut off from everyone else by a 10,000-strong infantry force that had camped out nearby, with hundreds of fellhound cavalry patrolling and running down stragglers. It wasn't an insurmountable obstacle, but it was keeping us from marching quickly to the rescue of anyone else. They hadn't attacked in force yet, but they didn't need to. They had reinforcements arriving every hour. Ours were 100 miles up the Poros, their barges frozen in place. The rest of the goblins that crossed in the initial invasion had spread out across the Gilmoran countryside in a vicious onslaught of fire and iron. Most of it was already deserted, thanks to their first invasion, but they spared no cost as they burned their way into the light of day. They were moving south, east, and west, and they were moving fast. They would encounter more densely inhabited areas within days. But they weren't unopposed. The Royal Commando units were alert to their approach, and by the time the first fellhounds encountered commando pickets, the men were ready. The first commando stopped the headlong advance toward the western Baronese Cold. The infamous Battle of the Bloody Dawn was fought that morning at Drensic, and 1,000 goblins and their hounds were slaughtered by 603rd commandos in a half-hour-long engagement before the castle gate. They made a song about that one. 100 other battles that morning were just as bloody, if less noteworthy. We had been taken by surprise. Our strategy had been focused on blunting the force of a powerful wedge, not fighting dozens of vicious skirmishes and chasing packs of hounds across miles of countryside. The larger concentrations of troops we had put together were useless against the piecemeal terror raids and sudden attacks at castles and manors all over Gilmora. Some places got hit hard and fast. Penny's manor was protected adequately. When the legion assigned to invest the place arrived, it walked into a devious magical trap. There were no survivors. Pentandra does not appreciate uninvited guests. Other places were not so fortunate. 30 miles to the southeast, a small castle in Renesi was invested by half a legion overnight. The skeleton garrison managed to keep the gate locked, but they were in dire peril. A fortified temple to the southwest was under assault for 2 days. A small band of war brothers and refugees battling against 10 times their number of Gavani. The human confederates of the goblins were particularly rapacious in their conquests. They put hamlet after hamlet to the torch and slew all who stood against them. I stood in the headquarters room and received dispatches as they arrived by messenger, hawk, mirror, and mind to mind. The Kasari were particularly helpful in bringing reports to High Magi in the field to be relayed back to us. But every report was grimmer than the last, and there was no end in sight. I felt defeated. We'd been outflanked, outmaneuvered. There were 100,000 more goblins coming down the cotton road, and they'd march straight to Barobel over our corpses. By mid-morning, I was fighting despair. The king was demanding answers, and I had few to give him. Telemann was just as overwhelmed, and every hour more goblins joined the throng outside our castle. Toward noon, it became clear we'd have to do something about that. At the time, I was livid with rage. How could things have gone so wrong so quickly? Why hadn't I foreseen this possibility? I paced back and forth through the headquarters room, my spear following behind me like a worried puppy. I felt like a failure. I stopped periodically to stare at the diorama, to see just how bad things were, and every time they seemed to be getting worse. Lance of Boone had a grim expression on his face as he swept the last representative of the second commando off of the board. "Killed to the last man," he said,
shaking his head. The war mage got away with a few priests and 40 troopers when he got separated from the unit and saw it was hopeless. He's headed this way now.
Damn,
I swore. The second commando had been the backbone of our defense of the center of Gilmora. How many Gavani there?
3,000 more than we thought,
he admitted, and a couple of those siege worms. That's what got them. I had yet to see one of the huge beasts in action, but from the descriptions Tyndall and Rondell had given me after their encounter with one here last summer, I could imagine how such a battle might go.
Master!
Someone, Dara, screamed into my mind. I'm headed for the rooftop. Can you meet us there?
What?
All right. Is there anything wrong? Shall I bring a medic?
No, we're unhurt. Just, I need to talk to you.
I sighed. The whole world was sliding into the abyss. 30,000 goblins were ravaging Gilmora. The kingdom could be at the brink of collapse if things didn't go well, and my 14-year-old apprentice wanted to talk to me. I went and talked to her. First, because the headquarters room was becoming unbearable and I needed respite. Secondly, because I don't ignore my apprentices when they want to talk to me. Despite being stupidly stubborn about many things, they did not get my attention unnecessarily. If Dara needed to talk to me, it wasn't about a boy crush. The wind on the roof of the spire cooled me nicely, but the distant roar of Gavani preparing to attack detracted from the experience. I spotted Frightful and her three wingmates circling the castle overhead, and when Dara saw me, her giant falcon dove elegantly. With a gigantic roar of wings, she glided to a halt, her feet, encrusted with blood and black fur, clinging to a crenellation. Dara waited until she was certain the bird was at rest before she climbed down. She was wearing what she called flying gear, a thickly padded gambeson, leather riding trousers, knee-high boots, thick leather gloves, a fleece-lined leather jack, and a helmet of waxed leather. Light, warm, and minimally protective. Her only personal weapon was her dagger. There was a limit to what the birds could carry, and it wasn't like the riders were dueling from the saddle. Except for those bloodied talons.
Dara, what did you—
I was interrupted by an armful of sobbing 14-year-old girl. To her credit, she only indulged in the act for a few moments before regaining her composure. Then she straightened, cleared her throat, wiped away her tears on the back of her gauntlet, and reported.
Master, there are two of those worms headed to here from the river. That's the 6th and 7th one I've seen today.
Are you sure? I asked. I think that would have shown up with scrying.
Yes, I am sure,
she insisted.
Two. A third the size of the dragon, but there's two. They'll take those gates down like they were made of mud, and a lot more goblins are headed this way, at least another legion of infantry. There's something else,
she added, biting her lip nervously.
They're putting up some sort of mist overhead. It makes it a lot harder to see what's going on down there.
Probably so that they can fight in full sunlight, I reasoned, and to obscure observation. Did it harm the birds?
No. We flew right through it, but it was hard. And a lot of the scrugs are moving west, up the river, just like it was a road, not crossing it right here. Master, things look... they look bad out there. Worse than Cambrian.
Of course they do, I soothed. Things are a bit turned around right now, is all.
Up the river, you say?
That might be significant. There are more targets there. You and your team are doing excellent work. I've been in headquarters hearing your reports, I said proudly. But how did poor Frightful's talons get...
disgusting?
She asked, wrinkling up her nose. We were flying back from the west when we saw a couple of humans, rangers, running from a pack of those awful dogs. Goblins too, of course, but they'd gotten most of those, and it was mostly the dogs.
I had my wing dive on them and stop them from chasing them,
she said sternly.
I hate those goddamn dogs. But, Master Min, what are we going to do? This isn't how things were supposed to go at all.
I know, I sighed. We must trust in the gods and answer the day the best we can. Have you orders?
Right now? Just fly patrol and spot. Why?
Water your birds, I ordered. Keep one in the air, but make sure the others are rested. I'm feeling very, very angry and frustrated right now, I explained gently, and there just happened to be about 10,000 goblins out there that need hitting.
And two worms,
she reminded.
Even better,
I sighed. Dara was right. Two of those nasty, six-legged worms 40 feet long and 10 feet at the shoulder, had joined the army preparing to attack us. The army was no laughing matter. Sir Festaren estimated a third of it was hobgoblin heavy infantry, two-thirds standard Gavani light infantry, a half-dozen trolls who showed up too, and there were a plethora of Sharul's priests outside to spread mischief. It was, without a doubt, the largest and most cohesive magical force on the field for the goblins so far in the invasion, and it was coincidentally the one facing the majority of the kingdom's high magi. Waiting for them to storm the castle just wasn't my style, nor Turlaman's. The Baron was eager to strike the Scruggs, who had the temerity to ravage his lands. We couldn't do much about the chaos in the countryside, but the goblins closest to hand presented an outstanding opportunity to vent our frustrations in a constructive way. There wasn't much of a plan about it. Mid-morning, Sir Festaren estimated that they would be ready to advance on Gavard Castle by dusk. We didn't intend to let them prepare the assault in peace. That wouldn't be sporting. Instead, we had our rangers move in and lay down heavy sniper fire. Every picket and patrol they sent out, the Kasari rangers silently and efficiently destroyed. A few minutes before noon, we opened the drawbridge, and 1,000 or so horsemen rode out, and rode away to the east, away from the invading army. The rest of us, along with the Alcan archers and another few dozen light horsemen, stole out of the gate and formed up between the castle and the townlands. We had a gracious plenty of heavy infantry among us, thankfully, mercenaries and men-at-arms who had been fighting in Gilmora for more than a year. They knew their business. Hell, they were eager. All of us were smarting from the deception and enchantment of the night's attack. Most had heard how the second commando had been butchered after the War Mage, War Brothers, and a few dozen stragglers made it to the castle after a daring cross-country withdrawal. The War Magi involved in the sortie, more than 50 in all, were particularly anxious to fight, and included the second commando men even though they were nigh exhausted. I was waiting in the scant shade of a pine tree with Turlaman, when the mercenary captain appointed to lead the mundane troops reported that they were ready. 3,000 heavily armed and armored men. It was more than a mile to the enemy position, but the captain assured us his men would sprint the entire way there for the chance to kill goblins. Captain Arborn joined us, along with Lady Ithalia, who was leading the Alka Alon auxiliaries. I had expected Onranian to lead them, but he wanted to stay with the War Magi in this battle. Arborn took off his close-fitting steel cap and shook out his hair.
"I've pulled my scouts back," he reported. "Most are hiding in places to cover your position in case of a retreat."
"That seems less than optimistic," Onranian snorted. "Surely there's no thought of retreat.
This is a battle in which we know little about the capabilities of our foes."
"Clearly," I said, gesturing to the frozen Poros in the distance. "Retreat may be tactically advisable at some point. Honor is lovely on the tournament field, but this is a war of genocide. I won't make a futile stand if I can avoid it, no matter how gallant. It's nice to know we'll have some cover."
"My people will endeavor to protect your magical core,"
Arborn said, sipping from his canteen. I glanced over at where Rondal and Tyndall were sparring with their mage blades to warm up. Sarakim was strapping a second quiver to his back. Saake was smashing logs to splinters with his new warhammer, and Lorcus was practicing the sword dance of the Magi at augmented speed. It was hard to even see his arms and legs move.
"You really think we'll need much protection?" I asked skeptically. Before the pretty Alcan could respond, Telamon bellowed for his captains to consult before the final horn called to attack. He gave a rousing speech to rally us all, and we needed it after the long night. He pointed out our splendid new allies, our giant falcons, and the concentration of magic at our command. He exhorted us all to do feats this day that would honor our ancestors and be the envy of our descendants. He finished it with a short but poignant prayer to Duin the Destroyer. He was good. Even I was cheering when he finished. Then it was time to don our helms, hang our spells, loosen our swords, and make our peace with the divine. The infantry quick marched in formation over the field and up the hill toward the gathering mass of goblin soldiery at the commands of the horns. The few horsemen went ahead, at first, to clear pickets and cavalry patrols before hugging our flanks. Those hounds were vicious, but even they could not stand a well-couched lance to the innards.
The magical core moved alongside the main column until we were just in sight of the foe, a stunning vision of black, furry malevolence that began howling the moment they saw us. Drums and horns called them to arms at once, and the cries of dismay told us that they were not expecting resistance so soon. As our men marched up the slight slope toward them, they hastily assembled a shield wall in defense. Mostly hobgoblins, with heavy wooden round shields, I noted with mage sight. There were a few clusters of goblins working to build siege engines behind them. I had no intention of letting that happen. The horsemen cleared out of the way and the archers among our men filed out and launched a volley at the Gavani. It fell like deadly rain, and the second they launched did as well. While the hobs in the front were fairly well protected, the light infantrymen behind them were peppered with 3-foot-long shafts. They tried to answer our volley with one of their own, but it was chaotic and poorly timed. It was also too short by 30 yards. But as soon as the arrows touched down, the horn call rang out and the infantry broke into a charge. We were running across the field ourselves, but we all slowed down a moment to appreciate the moment when our men rammed into their soldiers. Swords and spears began flailing wildly, like the center of a boiling pot, and the ranks behind the front began to press and spread out. As decent soldiers as the Hobbs were, they were still a head shorter and 70 pounds lighter than the average human infantryman. Nor were they as aggressive. Our men disassembled that shield wall like it was mowing time. Sometimes they would just bowl over a hobgoblin and then stand on its shield, using the additional height to his advantage before hopping down and dispatching him. The Gavani light infantry? They could barely stand against them. They tried. They threw themselves at the heavily armored men who marched up that hill. But their blows were too weak and too few to match the pounding and slashing they received in return. For every man who fell, 5 or more goblins died in that initial charge. It was good to see the violence going in our favor, but our tactical advantage wouldn't hold long. The goblins were already trying to get their worms into play. They were still outfitted as draft beasts, not war machines, so they were limited in how effective they were in combat. But honestly, how effective does a 40-foot-long monster have to be in order to get the job done? I pointed toward the beasts as we crossed the field. "Rundle? Tyndall? One for each of you. Master?" Rundle asked, confused, as he jogged behind me. "You two, deal with the siege worms," I explained, "since you have had experience with one before." I could hear their nervous swallows over the din of battle. "Yes, master," Rundle agreed reluctantly, before they both jogged off. We were approaching the main line from an oblique angle, just at the flank. Few of the Hobbs were paying close attention to such a small group, until the Alka Alon began firing their shiny bows. This was the first time I'd seen them in action. In their normal forms, they are famed for their archery, and the poisoned arrows they use. In their human-like forms, they were far deadlier. While the Alka Alon prefer sniping, they had been studying human-style warfare in Sevendor. I got to see what an Alka Alon volley looked like, perfectly coordinated, with the same effect I'd witnessed among the Karshak and in Carnaduin, and it was breathtaking. Their fingers flew so fast, they blurred, and their quivers emptied before my eyes as shaft after shaft filled the air with high, tinny twangs. Their human-sized bows were strong, far stronger than the average longbow, and the arrows they used were tipped with decorative steel and made of some bright white wood. The Humani-sized Alka fired fast, faster than any human I'd seen, even Sarakim, and their aim was exquisite. Rank after rank of Gavani fell to that deadly rain. I do not doubt that every Alkan arrow found a mark. As harrowing as that was to our foe, there were still plenty facing us ahead. Talaman turned and raised his sword, and a bright blue flare ignited from the tip, the signal to charge. I summoned the halberd blade from Blizzard's arsenal and activated several powerful spells of protection and augmentation as I ran close enough to discern the furry faces of my foes. In another 3 steps, the last of my spells were active, and I was ready to face the horde. After the punishing volley of arrows, the remaining goblins in front of us were in poor order when Telemann's sword exploded the first hob to step forward against him. He turned and struck a second, and kicked a third in the head as he twisted. Bendenald the outlaw was right behind him with his men, and as soon as they hit the line, they spread out and challenged the largest and fiercest opponents at hand.
I pushed to my left. Into the flank of the shield wall the infantry were attacking, my blade going slick with blood as I hewed one Gervan after